Hello everyone, I'm Marco Annunziata, co-founder of Annunziata and Desai Advisors, and I am an economist, PhD economist, formerly the chief economist at General Electric, where I was also the head of business strategy innovation. And my background really is in a mixture of experiences. I started my career in policy with the International Monetary Fund, and I worked for a while in finance. And then at GE, I had a chance to dive deep into the world of technology, especially digital technology. And that's where I carved out my area of expertise, which is really the interaction between macroeconomic and geopolitical trends with innovation and technology. And today I'm joined by my favorite co-host by far, who is James Villarubia. James is a spectacular co-host at NASA. And James, over to you for a brief introduction of yourself.
Thanks, Marco. You are also my favorite co-host. So it is great to be here again. And for those in the audience who've not heard one of my episodes before, my name is James Villarubia. I am the Presidential Innovation Fellow for the NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project. And my role at NASA is really to help them integrate AI into a lot of the research and science that they are doing on a day-to-day. Of course, AI has been really big this year. But before I got into AI, I had a career and a background in public policy, mostly around technology policy, or sort of not only how we write policy about tech, but how tech can actually be used to improve policy, where sort of policy making can get easier with tech and collaboration and sort of online democratization approaches. So it's really exciting to sort of have this conversation today with our guest. So I'll hand it over back to you, Marco, for an introduction.
Thank you, James. And yes, indeed, the conversation today will have a lot to do with both tech and policy, because our guest today is Maya Rao. She's a very accomplished journalist, renowned for her insightful coverage of issues of race, immigration, fracking, public policy, currently at the Star Tribune. Maya is also the author of a narrative nonfiction book on fracking called Great American Outpost: Dreamers, Mavericks, and the Making of a New Frontier. She has a very diverse background, spanning publications like the Philadelphia Inquirer, The Atlantic, The Nation. So she has a unique perspective of the intersection of societal shifts, emerging technologies, and environmental dynamics. But most important to me, and I think it will become clear to our audience today, is the kind of journalism that Maya has been doing, which is really in-depth, on-the-ground journalism aimed at giving us a sense, a color of what is going on, what the issues really mean on the ground concretely, and what they mean for the people involved in the issues in an everyday manner. Maya, thank you very much for being with us today. Welcome to the show. And why don't you kick us off with a better introduction of yourself than what I have done, and telling us a little bit more about your experience, what you've been doing, what you're passionate about.
Sure. Thank you so much for this introduction. I really appreciate the chance to be here. I've been a journalist for 17 years now, written for a variety of publications around the country, and currently I'm a senior writer for the Minneapolis Star Tribune, writing about race and immigration, but I've been passionate about covering a large range of topics, and I'm excited right now just going into the election season. Immigration is going to be a big issue, and so there's always a lot to cover there. But my passion, no matter what I'm covering, is to really spend a lot of time on the ground and get in depth into the nuances and past the usual really cut and dry headlines. So that's really what I enjoy the most.
Excellent. And why don't we start, Maya, on the topic of your book, which I mentioned in the introduction, book on the Great American Outpost. So this is based on the experience you had covering the fracking revolution, right? Why don't you give us a little bit more color on your experience there?
Sure. So this book was something I started in 2014, and that was a really pivotal moment in oil production in the U.S., and it was a really interesting time because I was actually starting to go out to North Dakota. And North Dakota is not a place that most people really have a familiarity with, but it, due to some new technology with fracking, even though there had always been some level of oil there, they were able to really develop North Dakota into the second largest oil producer in America after Texas. And it was really fascinating because Texas has been well developed for so long. It's just got a large population, a well-regulated infrastructure that everyone knows how to do these things. In North Dakota, there's a population that's already there, both a large white population, there's an Indian reservation, but it's a very rural area that was not used to this. So they sort of, it was just kind of like a remote frontier that kind of got bulldozed over by this massive industry, a lot of major companies from Texas and elsewhere, and people coming from all over the country and even the world looking for jobs, developing, fracking, starting different businesses, and it sort of brought in a lot of criminal elements and a lot of people who just wanted to take some money and go back to where they were from. But it brought up a lot of interesting issues in terms of how do you build up a society from the where there really hasn't been one before, where nobody's prepared to deal with these complicated regulatory issues. It almost felt like, yes, there's technically a government here. There's some city councils. There's a state regulatory agency that overlooks oil. But it really felt like it was kind of run by private enterprise in a way. Like there was no real sense that the government could have much control over what was going on. It was clearly a very lopsided battle that they were fighting. So I got to be there off and on for a couple of years. When 2014, prices of oil hit $100 a barrel, record highs at the time. And then they slowly began their decline until they collapsed in 2015, 2016. So I kind of got to see the boom, then I got to see the bust. And it's interesting when people track oil prices and they see the bust and oil production slows, and a lot of people will go back to where they were from. So it will look kind of quieter on the ground, but there's still all these people and institutions that had been there before and will still have to be there to kind of clean it back up. And so I was able to really look at some of the issues of overbuilding, like developers built way too many apartments. Everybody just kind of built way too much. It was a building frenzy. There was pipeline spills and environmental accidents and contamination people had to deal with for many years. So there's just always this question of, yeah, there will be people coming, making money and taking the profits back off into Texas, especially the oil companies based in Texas. The profits, their workers all come from there and go back. But then there's just the people who remain, who really have to deal with it. So it's fascinating to me to kind of get to see all different stages of the development of this frontier that a lot of people really never get to see.
It's interesting you draw on that sort of issue of sort of tax bases. I hadn't actually considered that as like, well, obviously there's going to be some revenue for the locality, but I can imagine actually a lot of the revenue, which we think of is really driven by either profit, but the company's not based there, or by tax revenue from income. But people, I mean, I assume there's probably, it sounds like a lot of sort of migratory workers like, oh, they're trucking to North Dakota, or they're based out of Texas and they're there briefly, but their state of residence is not North Dakota. So they're not paying taxes in North Dakota, or at least not significant taxes. I mean, was that sort of disparity evident to the local community when they brought this in? Did they even have a say saying, hey, like, how can we better capture this? Like, were they engaged in that conversation at all? Or did you see them sort of just accepting what was sort of seemed to be happening at City Hall and at the state capitol without their say?
Yeah, well, actually, there's like a lot of different places we've heard about are anti-fracking, or like, you have residents showing up to town hall saying, don't frack here. I mean, that wasn't really the situation in North Dakota. I think people were glad that there was some industry coming in. And if somebody had some mineral rights to oil wells, then they were getting some pretty big checks. I think a lot of people were glad that the economy was booming, because for so many years, that part of North Dakota was desperate for people. Like, everyone was leaving and the towns were dying. It was really a story of American rural decline in some of these middle parts of the country. But people naturally, they are pretty politically conservative. They don't necessarily believe in a heavy government regulation. They believe in free enterprise. So it wasn't necessarily the traditional debate you might see in some other places like Pennsylvania or Denton, Texas. But yeah, people definitely did point this out a lot, that, when you drive around, at least when I was there, it doesn't necessarily look like a really nice place. It doesn't look like a place that has a lot of money. It looks just kind of a rundown industrial area. You see trailers and trucks everywhere. And there was a businessman there named Marcus Junt I had been interviewing. He owns a number of the restaurants, several restaurants and bars there. And at one point in 2014, he ran for mayor against the local North Dakota-born mayor. And he was pushing that we need to get more of the money to stay here and really build something. And he lost. But he now spends a lot of time in Texas, and he was telling me when you're in Houston or even just different places in Texas, you can really see, wow, there's some big houses and nice neighborhoods, and you can see what maybe oil money built for people. And you don't necessarily see that in some places in North Dakota. I mean, you definitely see some, but it just doesn't, like when you're around, it doesn't necessarily show as much wealth as you would expect in terms of the actual infrastructure. People definitely have brought this up. It's definitely been a concern. I mean, I don't think anybody's ever said, like, we don't want any of this at all. It just needs to be better. We just need to find a way to keep more people and more money here, too, so we can benefit from it.
So you mentioned that you were there as a journalist, sort of the boom part and the bust part. Can you talk about what the experience was, sort of being in a small town with, it seems like sort of a story with a national thread? Like, how did you feel as a journalist? Hey, I'm trying to connect the dots here from Texas, from a large company to a small company. A small town, so small residents getting big checks. I mean, did it feel like your stories were resonating? Like, were you publishing for the North Dakota community? Were you publishing for the Texas community? Where do you think the audience was most getting value of the story you were telling?
I did a couple of stories for the Minneapolis Star Tribune where I was working. Mm-hmm. I did a big story for the Atlantic magazine. And then I was there working on a book for a New York publisher that was aimed at a national audience. And it was interesting because North Dakota did have a lot of small local community newspapers that were diligently covering what they could. But there was a huge influx of national reporters parachuting in from everywhere. So it's funny because when you try to interview locals, they were so used to seeing reporters and they'd say, well, I know somebody at the New York Times and I've got a friend at the Wall Street Journal and some reality show come here. So like, it was sort of like a joke that everybody was almost jaded by the fact that reporters were there. And I think it was challenging in some ways because, first of all, a lot of people there, they're usually politically conservative and they felt worried about like the idea that it would be some kind of liberal expose on fracking. They're just scared of like journalists being left wing and coming to do a hit job on fracking. And they just really, it would take a lot of time to earn people's trust. And I would say I think a lot of people there didn't necessarily follow all the your average oil worker. I don't know if they were like necessarily following all the national discourse on fracking because they did feel like very protective of their industry. They didn't like the idea of people being against it. And they felt a little bit defensive, like, well, how does, you know, all these people are showing up at protests on fracking in these other places and they drove their car to get there and people don't appreciate the sacrifices we make. So yeah, there's definitely some skepticism of the media. And I really found, though, that, and also it was hard to get some people to talk because there was so, this work, these odd hours, and nobody really has time to talk. So it's really helpful if you're there for a long time and just keep showing up and working around those restrictions, then I think people open up to you. And it was really helpful to me that I wound up deciding to do most of my reporting as a book, because I remember a lot of people in the oil industry would get fired for talking to you. So I know there were several key people I talked to that were important in my reporting. One was overseeing a drilling rig and one was a truck driver. And it was nice. There was a couple of years delay between when we talked and when the book was published. By then, they weren't working for their companies anymore. So it sort of gave it an extra degree of protection. And I think people can be more honest and open sometimes if they know, okay, not everything I'm saying is going in the newspaper tomorrow. Like, there's some time to be nuanced and really thoughtful and spend a lot of time with somebody. And then after a long period, something comes out. I think it's an interesting way to try to get at the truth a bit better.
It's a very good point, Maya, and I want to start connecting the dots from some of the issues you've raised, because I think that they make some very important points. So issues, you mentioned the issue of people's trust in the media and journalists. You've also highlighted the importance of thoughtful discussions where you can dive into issues both from your point of view, but also from the point of view of the people you're talking to, without being too worried about how they will splash on a headline the day after. And finally, you've mentioned the fact that, as you've seen, the impact on the local community in North Dakota of all this oil wealth was not as visible as it would have been, say, in places like Texas. And I think it's all this is bringing my thoughts, at least, to the issue of the importance of reflection and long term. So let me start with one consideration. It feels to me like the reason why you look at North Dakota and you say, well, there was all this money sloshing around, but it wasn't immediately obvious that much of it was being reflected in better housing, better infrastructure. And I think that's an important reminder to all of us that it takes time to build an economic ecosystem, to build a society. And perhaps in that case, the speed of with which the bust followed the boom was excessive. We have needed a lot more time of sustained growth in the sector for the economic benefits to become entrenched. But also you mentioned the tensions, the fact that the way I hear it from you is local people feeling both hopeful and a bit suspicious, hopeful that this new oil wealth will spur the growth of the local economy, suspicious of how it will be playing at the national level. And of course, this all goes to the issue of both domestic debate in the citizenry and then how that is reflected in the policy decision at the local and at the national level. And that's something where media and people like you play a very important role. Now, what strikes me, and I mentioned it at the beginning, is the fact that your style of reporting is almost more book writing than journalism, right? So you like going deep into the issues. And this is not really what we see in most of the media right now. The media is more, it's a faster paced and more relying on social media. So I'd be very curious to hear some of your reflections on how you've seen the world of journalism and the world of media changing over the years, and what you see as the main implications.
Yeah, well, it was interesting because I was really out there from 2014 to 2016. And I noticed it was around that time something sort of shifted, especially by 2015, 2016, in the normal media ecosystem. And I just feel like the news cycle really picked up pace, especially after Trump got elected in 2016. Everything just became relentless. I guess there's just so much going on in the world, but it's certainly changed a lot since I first started in journalism in 2007. And so it was really hard for me coming back, writing a book and going back into journalism. And I actually spent the first couple years of the Trump administration in Washington, D.C., reporting on Capitol Hill. And I mean, there's been so much good journalism that has come out in recent years, and so many places are doing a good job. But the news cycle is just very relentless. A lot of the jobs in journalism, they just increasingly become concentrated in New York and DC, and fewer jobs are kind of in the middle of the country or all these other places. There's been massive layoffs recently and buyouts, and the LA Times and Washington Post has had a huge round of buyouts and all kinds of questions with new ownership. So, I mean, DC and New York maybe where a lot of decision makers are and policy is being discussed, but it plays out on the ground in some of these communities that like don't necessarily have that many reporters. Like, I mean, in North Dakota, I thought it was interesting that there were a lot of national reporters kind of parachuting in for a while, but only Reuters had one full-time journalist for a while. But I mean, North Dakota is not a place usually where like somebody's going to put a full-time reporter. Even my own paper in Minneapolis didn't do that. I thought they should have done that. You know, I was recently just at the border because I'm an immigration reporter on the southern border in El Paso. Like there's not, I mean, you have local papers and publications, but I don't know that there's, you know, as many national reporters as there could be in some of these areas, and they're remote areas. I mean, there's a lot of places in the country where this public policy is actually playing out on the ground, and I really wish we had more people who could actually show us what that looks like, and not so many people just all concentrated in Washington. But yeah, it's really helpful to have people who can be on the ground, and really, it's hard to get quality information if you just kind of parachute in for a quick trip, and to really get the nuances, especially with people who don't always feel comfortable just talking right off the bat. And those people are often the best sources, but it takes some time to earn people's trust and for them to keep seeing you and get them to open up.
I really, that story that you told about the restaurateur, running for mayor and trying to keep money in that town, I guess I can imagine that local journalists and sort of local community members sort of in local news would have been very helpful in sort of playing out that debate for like, well, what does this mean for the town? Not necessarily what does it mean for like the national debate on fracking. But I suspect that a lot of the national reporters that sort of paradropped in and were sort of covering it, they were covering it from a national fracking news. And even if there were sort of local coverage, it was more for color of the story and not necessarily pointing out sort of the public policy issues for that town or for the state. I mean, do you feel like, is there a gap that is forming there in sort of like how sort of civic engagement and sort of local news or the loss of local news is really impacting civic engagement? Because I guess I'm seeing if it's all becoming national news, then who is there to sort of put pressure and to talk about the local mayor campaign? I don't know. I can imagine that have going a different way had there maybe been a different mix of journalism in the area. But I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Actually, I will say that in North Dakota, in that area, I thought there was strong local coverage. They did cover that election. They have very small local newspapers that cover these things, that will cover something like a mayor's election. That's kind of a classic thing that a community newspaper would write about. I think the challenge was more covering large out-of-state companies and a huge private industry coming in. That's usually beyond the capacity that local newspapers could fully cover all that in depth. But I think they did a decent job. I actually just thought that having more national reporters face their full time when they transmit like news nationally would have been more helpful, because these local newspapers do a good job with what they have. I don't think they're really read outside of North Dakota, and they don't have as many resources as they could have had.
Do you have a sense, Maya, because I actually feel very strongly about what you've been pointing out, which is with the decline of local news, local media, we've lost a very precious pulse on what is going on in a lot of the country outside the main centers, the main cities on the two coasts. And I'm wondering if you've seen it have an impact on policy making, I would say, both at the local and at the national level. At the national level, my immediate concern is that if we don't see what is happening in local communities across the country, we don't really understand how different economic issues, different social issues are playing out there. And therefore, even if policymakers themselves are informed, they have to take decisions and get the feedback from a general public who is not informed. So my concern there is it may lead to suboptimal policymaking. And then I'm also curious, at the local level, is it different? Are people informed anyway simply because they are there and they get the news anyway? Or does the decline of local news and local media also create a situation where a lot of people at the local level in smaller cities tend to focus more on national news because that's what they read about?
Right. I've worked in places that have a decimation of local news and some that are doing pretty well. But there's definitely a lot of misinformation. I was just in Western Wisconsin. There was this push, and it's happened in a few places, where they wanted to really crack down on refugees. Western Wisconsin is near the Twin Cities where I'm based. The Twin Cities gets a lot of, it's really a hub of refugees, one of the largest hubs in the U.S. And refugees, they are vetted ahead of time when they're abroad in a refugee camp, and they come here through a legal pathway. But I was attending these public county commissioners meetings in Western Wisconsin, where there was just a push to have much to kind of stop any refugee arrivals from coming and to just crack down on that, because there were some plans to have some come to the area. And one thing I noticed, there were these huge crowds coming, and there was so much misinformation where people were getting refugees mixed up with all the migrants who were coming over the border. Like, they didn't really know the difference. So they were thinking like, oh, there's just saying like all these illegals are crossing the border and they're coming here and they're taking our things. And there was misinformation where they didn't understand, well, no, those people at the border aren't officially refugees. The refugees who are coming, they've been vetted ahead of time. They're here, they'll be coming here legally. Whatever's happening at the border is a problem, but that's not what we're talking about here. It's like a lot of people would get whipped up with resentment about things and not know some of the basic differences in asylum seeker versus refugee. And, you know, the council meeting, I mean, even one of the public officials had to be corrected himself. I mean, there were residents that had to be corrected. There's a lot of, I'm guessing, I don't know if they're watching certain types of news programs or things. It could be easy to get confused, or people just, you're a refugee and that's a flashpoint. There's a lot of negative connotations. So, I mean, I was even talking to my editors about how soon, especially in this politically charged election year, I even should do a digital explainer for our media outlet, kind of explaining the differences, the numbers between refugees, asylum seekers, the people on humanitarian parole who came from Afghanistan and Ukraine, all different legal definitions that come with different types of benefits or disadvantages. And a lot of people just don't know some of the stuff. And even in our newsroom, we talk about some of the things that we take for granted, items of information, maybe we need to do a better job explaining them. But at least in Minnesota, where I'm based now, it's one of the things that drew me here is that it has a high rate of civic participation, very high rates of news readership. I used to be a reporter in New Jersey for many years. That is a situation where the local news really has been decimated, but it's also a state with a very high degree of public corruption. So, I mean, it's kind of in the shadow of Philadelphia and New York. A lot of people commute there and kind of pay attention to the news in Philadelphia and New York, but all the little, there's like 566 municipalities in New Jersey, each with their own governments and their own patronage contracts and things like that. So New Jersey has had a long record of public corruption investigations and politicians and public servants going to jail. We just had a huge indictment in the past week of the most powerful Democrat in New Jersey, George Norcross, for racketeering. So and various other public officials aligned with him. And so in that was based on some actions in Camden, New Jersey, across the river from Philadelphia. And I used to be a reporter around that area. And the local newspaper had really been decimated. The paper where I had worked at the time, the Philadelphia Inquirer, had really just experienced a lot of layoffs and a lot of shrinkage. And the just various other newspapers in the state have really suffered. So I just think there's a lot of corruption in New Jersey that probably is still going undetected, that's not really covered as much. So it is a real challenge outside of a big city. Kind of, I think there's just different local, smaller online outlets that sometimes can pick up the slack, but that doesn't always happen. So it's a huge, there can be a huge variation depending on where you live. And then my parents, that's where I'm from, is the DC suburbs where they are. I think the Washington Post has cut back quite a lot on some of that local suburban news that you used to get in a lot more detail. Yeah, and that's just a continuing challenge that we're facing right now.
I did want to ask, I mean, you mentioned sort of the beginning, I know we talked about sort of your North Dakota time, but you've also been sort of on the race and immigration and social issues beat. I guess I'm interested in the intersection between trying to tap into stories of marginal communities and what their experiences are. And these are people who may not be big buyers of sort of newspapers. They might be high information consumers in other contexts. But I mean, I guess my question is, do you feel like journalism today, sort of the trend is broadly across journalism, are we seeing those marginalized groups have more of a voice through journalism, or is the struggle harder? Are they being sort of further marginalized by a lack of ability to participate in sort of the journalism ecosystem? Because I can imagine, I mean, I coming from somewhat of a digital space, I know that sort of the digital bubbles have formed in sort of the wake of social media, where it's like, well, I'm happy in my community, I don't need to go and share elsewhere. Is that sort of happening at sort of a larger scale within sort of journalism because of the cuts? Like, well, I can only tell so many stories, I can only fund so many journalists. Are you seeing that impact sort of the accessibility of sort of race and immigration and these other sort of stories coming from the sort of those marginalized communities?
In where I'm based at the Star Tribune about 5 years ago, we had a Somali American journalist leave, and he wound up founding a media outlet called the Sahan Journal, which is online and it's dedicated to covering communities of color in Minnesota. And they've done an excellent job. And there's just so much news to cover about immigrants and people of color here. And I've seen different initiatives like that in different places, some that will specialize and pop up to kind of pick up the slack where mainstream media outlets aren't doing enough of it. So I've always been interested in writing about issues or people that I think aren't being covered enough. It might not be for racial reasons. It could be that they're in a rural area or just people that aren't being written about enough. So I'm interested in that. But I know, I mean, as the media has cut back in different areas, clearly there would be less ability or less space to cover that. And it certainly takes a while. But I think the challenge is, like, sometimes covering those communities, it can take longer or be a little bit harder. I mean, you have to build trust. Sometimes they speak a different language, so you have to go through interpreters, and that everything with an interpreter takes twice as long. Or you're dealing with people that may have just had a historic and rightful distrust of the media, or they just have some sort of situation where it would make them very vulnerable to be talking about something with the press. So all of that, it just takes longer and takes more resources. And I mean, that's something I do get concerned about whenever I see cutbacks at different places.
And sorry for cutting you off, because what you're saying now, and something you were mentioning earlier about the example of something new moving, somebody moving on from traditional journalism to found a new outfit to cover issues which are underreported. I'm wondering if, looking forward, you have 17 years of experience in the field, and you've made a conscious effort throughout to try to do what too many people are not doing. So give us the news and the reporting of people and issues that are not sufficiently covered. And I'm wondering, what we do in this podcast is always try to look forward and try to figure out, okay, given what's happening now, what might the future look like? And what I see from what you're telling me is a situation where traditional media, traditional journalism is in crisis, partly because it has failed us. I mean, you are painting a picture of crisis in some of the main media outlets, shrinking, reducing the workforce. We also know, reading it everywhere, that the trust in the media is at an all-time low. And that might be linked to something else you were saying earlier, which is the time when the media started trying to move faster and cover issues at a faster pace and maybe in a less thoughtful way. So I'm wondering, including by leveraging technology. Now that finding information, disseminating information in some ways is faster and easier than ever. Is there a future where people like you, people like like-minded souls in the media industry, in journalism, can also leverage the involvement of more people on the ground and technology so as to create a new kind of on-the-ground journalism, something that brings us back towards a more thoughtful coverage of the issues, but leveraging technological instruments that to some extent may have contributed to undermining traditional journalism, but now might hold the key to bring us forward to a different model?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm definitely seeing so many promising startups that pop up and just different efforts. I think it's challenging when we look at how they're sustained long term. There's also been a lot of outlets that have closed or struggled. But yeah, I do think technology has made it easier to reach more people and get different voices, to access different voices and a greater diversity of voices. Yeah, I think that technology can be leveraged. It's just challenging when you think about how to really get a long-term future, that, because the traditional business model of newspapers had been very successful for a long time. Before the internet and the fragmentation of media and news gathering kind of came about. And I don't know that anyone's found something that kind of has that long-term sustainability.
Yeah, I really take that last point. I think that sort of the rise of social media has strangely sort of the web 2.0, if people are sort of familiar with that term, is this, oh, it's free, it's online, it should be free. And we sort of fail to sort of emotionally as a culture say, hey, just because it's online doesn't mean it's entirely free. It might be cheaper. I'm not paying for paper. I'm not paying for ink, but I'm still paying for a journalist. And I think that the variable costs versus fixed costs here on sort of producing an article, I put it in economic terms for Marco. I think that we haven't quite grasped that as a society. And I think we've pivoted towards things that are free. So I'm interested to your point, Maya, it's like the who figures it out? Who, like your friend, sort of establishes an online community and can sort of find a way, if that's niche or whatever it might be, sort of focusing on the uncovered topics. How do the large newspapers who are all sort of competing over the same stories these days, how do they make sort of headway for themselves and make a market for themselves? I'm interested to see how that plays out in the future with sort of civic engagement. But I mean, it seems like I was sort of struck by your comment earlier about the small and the local journalists, the small shops in North Dakota are actually pretty rigorous when we're covering that mayoral election. That was surprising to me. And then you've got sort of the big players. Maybe it's that middle market, that mid-sized things that are being maybe left behind that I guess I don't know. I have so many ideas swirling in my head. I have to sort of keep an eye out. So this was a really great conversation. Marco, I want to turn it over to you. I mean, what are your final thoughts on this conversation today?
Thanks, James. Yes. Yeah, so my final takeaways are that if I look at the future, James, I think the future has to be a mixture of the new and the old. So part of it will have to be leveraging new technologies and the ease with which we can even crowdsource information, crowdsource news. But going back also to some of the traditional reporting, in-depth, on-the-ground reporting that Maya has been doing. Because I think, especially if you think of the concerns that are emerging with the potential for deep fakes and other sort of breaches of trust with artificial intelligence, I think the human element, so having people, professional journalists, who are there, who talk to people, who see what is going on, who can report about it honestly with a human dimension, I think is going to be more and more important. And if we think of the issues of how do we move forward towards better policies, which are better for sustainable economic growth throughout the country, and they're socially sustainable as well, I think this is going to be the most important thing that we can do. So this has been a great conversation. Maya, thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you for the crucial, important work that you've been doing. And we hope you will continue to do it for another 17 years and then another 17, and as long as it takes to get a new model in place. And thank you, James.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate that.
Great pleasure.